You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Hey, listeners, welcome. It is Wednesday, February 25th. Lots of exciting things in the world of auto safety. How is that possible? Didn't we solve auto safety problems with airbags and seatbelts and crumple zones? I mean, no, we made it better, but then there's things like Waymo. That's right. Lots of Waymo this week. Wait, why aren't you guys going to talk about Tesla a lot? Don't worry, we'll get to Tesla too. So last week we talked about how Waymo testified in front of Congress and said words, and then some Congress people were like, yeah, specifically Senator Markey is like, I got some questions. And he wrote a list of questions. Waymo wrote back, and we've read through them, and they're fascinating. So a lot of Markey's questions are around remote drivers. Do you guys have remote drivers? You have people located in the Philippines. They're remotely taking over control of your cars. And Waymo, again, their public relations are like the chef's kiss. It's amazing because like, no, these are assistants. They're not drivers. And Junko Yoshida goes into a great breakdown of this. Is like, why would they be so upset about using this term of calling them a driver? Who cares? And she kind of points out basically, oh, this is a legal loophole. They're trying to claim that these people, even though they take over the dynamic driving task, Waymo claims they've never done it, but they have the ability, but we've never done it. You're essentially a driver, even if you're telling a vehicle to go to the side of the road. But Waymo doesn't want to say that because then, you know, laws. Because I think if you're sitting in the Philippines, odds are you probably don't have a U.S. driver's license. That's my takeaway.
They're saying that, you know, they have Philippine driver's license that they verify frequently. So that's obviously not transferable to the United States. But I mean, I think beyond, you know, some of the legal issues that were detailed in Junko's article, which involve essentially the fact that the automated driving system is not capable of being held accountable to consumers. It doesn't have money. You can't sue an automated driving system. You know, essentially what we're looking for in federal law is a provision that makes the manufacturer or the person who sells and installs the automated driving system in a vehicle to have to be the responsible party when anything goes wrong. You know, we don't want to see situations where a passenger in a vehicle is blamed for not hitting the red stop button. We don't want to see situations where, you know, someone is hit on the street and has no recourse whatsoever other than potentially using the product liability, a product liability lawsuit, which would be incredibly expensive, you know, very difficult to prove out certain parts of it, given the use of AI in these feature in these vehicles. But beyond that, you know, I think Waymo is, I don't know that that's Waymo's only concern here. I think one of their predominant concerns is pushing back on this remote narrative, because there is, and I think we need to acknowledge that there's a giant gap between what Waymo is doing, what Tesla is doing, and an RC car, right? I mean, we have RC cars where they're fully remotely controlled by a human. We've got Tesla vehicles, which are presumably operating using full self-driving some of the time, but rely on falling back to a human that can immediately take control of the vehicle physically with the steering wheels and brake pedals, even from a remote location. And then we have Waymo, who is saying, you know, our cars are driving themselves all the time, but when they encounter a problem and they pull over and don't know what to do, our folks back in their control room are basically making suggestions to the vehicle about what its next move needs to be. And then the vehicle goes from there with that assistance. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that there's a big difference there.
Well, it's it's confusing because I'm going to quote from Waymo's responses. So the question was whether your company ever allows remote operators to teledrive a vehicle beyond providing guidance to the AV. And quoting from Waymo's response, nor are the humans able to start driving an AV remotely. Waymo has developed a tool that is reserved as an additional safeguard for a rare set of potential situations to assist a stopped AV fully onto the shoulder from the adjacent lane on a high-speed road. In such situations, a specially trained U.S.-based agent could prompt the AV to move forward at 2 miles per hour for a short distance at fixed steering angles to exit the travel lane. So they're saying that it looks like their humans are not able to start driving an AV remotely, but we have a tool that allows humans to drive an AV remotely.
Yeah, in an emergency situation. And they say that functionality has never been used.
Yeah, they're trying to claim two things at once. No, it's impossible to do this. We have a tool that allows them to do this, but we've never done it. So then it begs the question, why would I believe you?
I mean, particularly since all of your operations are you know, essentially non-transparent.
Right.
We have no way to assert one way or the other whether that feature has been used. We have to rely on, you know, their assertion again.
Yes, that's where it gets tricky because, again, so I'm saying they're saying we'll allow the AV to move at 2 miles per hour, which I then go back to the argument from Junkie Yoshida and from Phil Copeman and Missy Cummings. Well, if it doesn't matter the speed of the vehicle, if someone's remotely controlling the vehicle at any speed, aren't they the driver?
Yeah, and doesn't that and when they're doing so, doesn't that bring in concerns of latency and the other issues that we're concerned about with remote driving? I mean, they do specify that in those cases, it is a U.S.-based emergency. I guess this is ERT, emergency response team, or something like that.
Yeah, they've got a lot of acronyms.
That's doing it then, and not, you know, someone from the Philippines where there would conceivably be additional latency, but it still raises the question, you know, ultimately is this vehicle capable of, you know, autonomous operation, or is this, you know, did they need to hedge that? I mean, obviously though, since we're seeing a lot more, you know, incidents on our roads, crashes, deaths, injuries involving the type of partial autonomy that Tesla's deploying and now claiming they're developing into a fully autonomous system, when we still don't really have any good information, and in fact all information points to Tesla using remote drivers significantly, you know, whether it's, you know, in a control room or even, you know, following or tailing the robo-taxis they deployed in Austin to somehow circumvent the local rules there. There's just so many questions here, and it just, for me, it begs, you know, kind of goes back to why Senator Markey's asking these questions in the first place is, you know, I think to point out a deficiency in federal regulation in this area and the fact that we really need some regulations around remote operation of vehicles, not only just to ensure their safety, but also to provide some transparency as to what's actually going on here.
That is the problem.
Wait a minute. I'm sure you're familiar with George Orwell, right? Double speak, double think.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the necessity for a new term last week called fecal locution. This is a great example of fecal locution, which is public utterance of bullshit. I think what this is all coming from is the, 1992 Communications Act, Michael, that allowed the
96, the Telecommunications Decency Act,
allowed the internet lords to escape liability for anything that came across their portals, right? And I think that trained Waymo and its overlords at Alphabet to expect complete indemnification from any consequences of their actions. And I'm bleeding into my gaslight here, by the way.
Well, don't do that too much. But, you know, I see, I mean, what you're saying essentially goes along with, you know, kind of what's going on and what we've already talked about before in the area of terms of use. And, you know, these companies, because software companies have long used, you know, arbitration and other terms in their, you know, EULA or their what you agree to when you download and install the software and use it, you're essentially saying, you know, I'm going to hold you harmless for any bad things that happen because of this. They're expecting to be able to, software companies generally are expecting to be able to transfer that type of immunity onto, you know, operations in the physical world, which, you know, is where a lot of the problems we're seeing, you know, involving state law and federal law.
And of course, the difference here is bloody bodies and the software issues associated with, you know, the stealing and abusing intellectual property generally did not involve any actual personal injury. But here we're talking about a completely different environment. And the companies, the developer companies, are trying to extend that legal framework that was developed for non-lethal communications into the lethal world of industrial machinery. Anyway, you've heard that before, but that's where I'm headed with my gas. Should we do the gaslight already?
You seem very eager.
Formalize it? Sure. Well,
before you do the gaslight, though, hey, listeners, if you want to hear Fred's gaslight, go to autosafety.org and click donate. Okay, go ahead.
You can hear it anyway. But so I'm just giving it to Waymo for insisting that the computer is always in charge of driving and remote assistance is merely providing suggestions. This is nonsense. This has the apparent intention of diverting attention from the liability of corporate entities, human control, software design, development, implementation, validation, and maintenance. When the customers who've already signed away their rights by accepting the terms of service and other road users who have not, are injured or killed. Suing a computer as though it's independent of the humans who put it in harm's way would insulate the developers from financial liability. And that is exactly where they're headed. So thank you. That's my gaslight.
That's pretty good. I'm going to do mine now. Mine's also Waymo, because part of the responses to Senator Markey includes this little pickle of a line. We validate that the system performs as designed in every software release cycle. Now I know you're sitting at home going, yeah, what? That means nothing. That's nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. And how do we know it's nonsense? Because in 2024, Waymo's didn't have a problem with school buses. At some point, they released the software update, and all of a sudden, Waymo's can't deal with school buses. So I don't know what their validation is, because they're saying, hey, our system performs as designed in this software release cycle. And this software release cycle said, school buses stopping, hit the kids, let's go for it, screw this. Hey, there's police at an intersection and there's a gunfight, just drive through. I mean, maybe that's what it is, but I don't think it is. I think this is just more word soup from Waymo, because having worked on very large scale and even small scale software products.
I think the recent school bus issue with them not being able to fix it would point to that as well.
Right, but here's the Waymo logic, okay? Let's assume for the moment that in fact it did perform exactly as designed. Well, design depends upon the requirements. And engineers will design something based upon a set of requirements. So what they did not say is that they ever allowed their design requirements to have any public review or to be vetted by people who have public interest in mind. So to say that it performed exactly as designed is actually very slippery, because what they should have said and what somebody should have asked them is, what are your design requirements? Did your design requirements include avoiding running over children in school buses? How did you set that up? And how did you respond to that design requirement? The key here is that
that's confidential business information, and we don't have to tell you.
Well, I know. And that's the gap here, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That they never reveal what their requirements are. So they can say, well, you know, it performed according to requirements. Well, what the hell does that mean?
Nothing. You're stealing my gaslight now, man. But hey,
I'm reinforcing you, Anthony, just because I love you. That's fine.
Man, look at that. Fred's voting for my gaslight. So I got Fred voting for me. Of course, I'm voting for me. Good luck, Michael, with your gaslight. Good luck.
Really? Well, you know, my gaslight is moving into the, you know, who I'm focused on as the worst performer in this area, which is Tesla. But essentially, Tesla, after complying with the California DMV and the court order in that case, and shutting off the name Autopilot, and I guess moving those functions into full self-driving, after complying with the DMV's order, is now going back and suing the California DMV and trying to revoke the decision that they were misleading consumers by calling, you know, their systems Autopilot and full self-driving. Essentially they're trying to rewrite history, even though the order from California had incredibly minimal effects on Tesla's operation. Because essentially, you know, Autopilot is still there, although it's not named Autopilot. The functions that we're presuming have been moved into the full self-driving package that supervised. that is now being sold to consumers as a subscription. So essentially, Tesla's escaped from that entire debacle without any sort of punishment from, you know, the federal government or state governments for 10 years of misleading consumers, and many of them who ended up in crashes that killed them or others outside of their vehicle. So it's mind-boggling the extent Tesla goes to, you know, and they're even claiming that this is somehow an infringement of their First Amendment rights to corporate speech. Well, anyone who knows anything about corporate speech and the First Amendment knows that misleading language is not protected under the First Amendment. So they've got a long road to hoe, I think, hopefully, in attempting to get that order rescinded. It's essentially they just don't want it on their record that they misled consumers, when I don't see how it could be any clearer that they did. I mean, you can't call your house a full self vacuuming house or say it's got an auto vacuum if it's telling you that you have to hold on to the vacuum handle while it moves around the house so it doesn't inhale your cat, right? I mean, and you can't put all of this marketing junk out on Twitter, you know, showing people operating these vehicles with no hands and blah, 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 and this continuously harping on autonomy in public, and then saying, oh, well, we warned you, you know, on page 43 of your owner's manual that this system's not autonomous, despite the fact that we're clearly alluding to autonomy in virtually all of our marketing efforts outside the owner's manual. So it's, you know, disappointing. I guess I could say I would be disappointed if it wasn't so expected out of Tesla to pursue this type of legal wrangling. But that would be my gaslight of the week, essentially trying to pretend that none of this ever happened.
That's pretty good. Now, it was clear that I was the winner because both of you got very enthusiastic and supporting and adding to what I said. But Michael, you won, and you don't even realize why you won. You won by accident because you put in an Elon Musk giggle line. You said a long road to hoe. And, you know, that would make Elon Musk giggle like the schoolboy that he is. And for that, I mean,
thank you. I thought it was going to be, you know, the vacuum inhaling the cat.
No, as an owner of three cats, I found that offensive. You almost lost because of that. But related to Tesla and their nonsense. So Tesla, since what, 2016, of saying the cars drive themselves, we have self-driving, that problem solved, blah 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 blah. And in their filing now with the filing with the California Public Utilities Commission, quoting from an Electric article, Tesla basically says, yeah, we have remote operators. We have this is just a level 2 system. There's somebody inside the car. These are not driving themselves whatsoever. We're better than Waymo, which is the most amazing argument, because for a decade now they've been saying we drive ourselves, these cars are great, and they have, you know, dummies go on TV, like Howie Mandel, be like, my car, I haven't driven myself in years. Oh God, please don't drive anywhere near this guy. But these are all Teslas coming out saying these cars do not drive themselves. Absolutely not our robo-taxi thing. We got somebody in the car. We got somebody behind the car. We've got remote people driving it. They've got more drivers in this car than, I don't know, insert a metaphor for lots of drivers. They got a lot of backseat drivers.
When the Titanic was sinking, the captain ordered that flares be sent up to alert other ships in the vicinity that there was a problem. The other ships in the vicinity interpreted those flares as just some kind of party that was happening on the Titanic. And I'm thinking more and more that all of these press releases from Tesla are equivalent to the flares the Titanic was sending up, because the whole Tesla stock value is built upon bullshit and speculative belief in all of these pronouncements that are coming out of what's his name? Elon. And boy, that has a precedent in history of shipping, I think.
That childhood trauma is really still affecting you, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think the interesting thing in the Tesla's public utility submission to California is a couple of things. They're pushing back against a suggestion that Waymo made to the commission, that anytime a consumer gets into one of the level two vehicles operating, that they have to get affirmative consent from the passenger that it's okay to use those systems while the ride takes place. Tesla's saying, well, they already agreed to that in, you know, the terms of service when they agreed to the ride or agreed to join our system. And so we don't need to obtain affirmative acceptance of level two operation before each ride, which is, you know, yeah, again, I don't think something that is appropriate. I mean, I think a consumer should be able to say, hey, I really don't want you operating full self-driving while I'm in this vehicle. I don't trust it. I don't think it should be an automatic based on, you know, an agreement to a provision in a terms of use, which consumers are never going to read. Also, they, you know, Waymo says that, you know, vehicles operating at level two, like Tesla is in California right now, should not be permitted to market or refer to their level two services, driverless self-driving or robo-taxi, which obviously Tesla's going to agree with. And they're saying that's wholly unnecessary because the state DMV already has a regulation that prohibits making false and misleading statements in vehicle marketing. Which, you know, Tesla is essentially saying, you know, on one hand, we're suing the DMV over here to overturn their conclusion that we made false and misleading statements over here. But at the same time, this DMV regulation is what is going to protect consumers from that type of behavior. So it's a complete contradiction going on there, you know, Tesla making the most use of its money to, I guess they didn't have the same law firm on this case as they do on the other, who knows, but it is very contradictory arguments that Tesla's making here.
So there's a USA Today article we're linking to, and I'm going to quote from it. Ready? Michael Brooks, executive director of the Washington-based Center for Auto Safety, cool, which advocates for stringent regulations. Okay, said in a statement provided to USA Today that California's decision to back off the idea of suspending Tesla's license is just the latest evidence that neither the federal or state authorities can act in a timely and effective manner to keep car shoppers from being lured by the deceptive vehicle marketing. Those are some spicy words now.
I don't think they're that spicy. No, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, Autopilot came out in, you know, 2015. You know, California took 10 years, you know, despite, you know, we alerted them on Teslas in 2018 and 2019 saying, hey, this is deceptive advertising, deceptive marketing. It runs afoul of California statutes on that. And the DMV needs to do something about it. Well, they took their time, you know, 7 years later after we got in touch with them, they went through this process, got a decision that essentially Tesla just removed the name Autopilot, sidestepped the decision, and suffered no consequences whatsoever, other than all the money they had to throw at their lawyers. So it's, you know, and then on a federal level, you know, we've seen numerous investigations into Tesla. We saw a recall on Autopilot that essentially did very little to ensure either what the recall was supposed to do, which is ensure that these systems were only able to operate where they're designed to safely, you know, basically ensuring that they're restricted to an operational design domain. None of the, and also, you know, driver monitoring features were mentioned that, you know, would presumably be able to pick up better on humans who weren't properly supervising the vehicles. We haven't seen any evidence that the recall performed by Tesla was effective at all in restricting that. So it raises the question, and I think it's a pretty obvious, you know, statement that, you know, we've had these vehicles on the road 10 years killing people. Right. And the federal government and state governments, you know, over that decade, here we sit in 2026, and there have essentially been nothing done to stop the problem. And we fully expect that that's only going to lead to more problems as more manufacturers deploy these, you know, level two plus systems that, you know, kind of give the operators the sense that the vehicles are autonomous, but still require the operator to take over at any moment.
Well, Tesla has basically stated that our vehicles are not autonomous at all whatsoever. It sounds like from this latest filing, right?
I don't think that's what they're saying, but I mean, I think that's what we should all understand.
Yeah. Okay. Right? Because that's what it's clear they're trying to ask for here. But another thing they're asking for is this is around handing over their full self-driving traffic violation data to NHTSA. Quoting from another Electric article, Tesla has secured a second deadline extension from NHTSA in the agency's investigation into traffic safety violations committed by vehicles operating with full self-driving. The new filing dated February 20th pushes the deadline for Tesla to deliver critical crash data, including video, event data recorder, and CAN bus files to March 9th, 2026. The original deadline was January 19th. So my simplistic takeaway is that Tesla has all of this data. They've got it on their mothership. Do they call it a mothership or something like that? All their cloud. So they have all this data. NHTSA said, give us this data. And Tesla's like, I think I unplugged the Ethernet cable. Like, I don't, what's the Wi-Fi password? Like, what?
Well, they're saying they have a ton of records that we have to comb through, and we can only get through, I think they said in January, 300 per day. And they've got, I think, over 8,000 records. So they're, you know, requesting essentially another month to get through those the time. Well,
why do they have to comb through them? It's not the Epstein files.
Well, I mean, if you're of this opinion that I have about Tesla, they comb through anything before, and most companies, I'm assuming, are going to comb through anything they're submitting to a regulator.
So they can sit there and be like, this is obvious us, delete. Is that essentially what they're allowed to do? Like, this is our fault. Let's remove the data.
Yeah. I mean, look, this data is in their servers, right? And they're not just going to turn over a copy of their server to NHTSA, I don't think. I mean, I think they're going to comb through all these records, and, you know, maybe they're going to remove incidents where there's clearly not a problem. I mean, you know, it could happen.
But who's deciding that? That's the problem. Like, NHTSA
Tesla's deciding it, just like Tesla's deciding what kind of data they're going to report about their vehicle safety performance.
And so NHTSA has no...
There's no independent insight into any of these things.
So NHTSA has no compelling authority or anything to be like, no, hand over your raw data.
They could directly subpoena it if they had, you know, the stones to do it, which is something that we wish NHTSA would do a whole lot more with automakers, you know, across the spectrum, not just Tesla, but be a lot more direct in their requests. However, I think the agency feels that doing so would significantly limit future cooperation from these same companies.
Well, the administration is not going to go very hard against Tesla.
Right.
Yeah. So, but I'm going to request going into the Tau now, because it follows on to what Michael's just been talking about.
Let me think about it.
All right. How long?
Can you hand me $20?
I can virtually. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Okay. Hey, listeners, if you want to hear the Tau, go to autosave.org and click on donate. Take it away, Fred.
All right. So there's a trap that's being set by the industry, and it follows on to what Michael was just talking about. What is the operational? You talked about the vehicle operating within its ODD, or operational driving domain, Michael.
Design domain.
What does that mean?
Isn't it design domain?
Operational design domain, yeah. So what does that mean to you?
What? Operational design domain?
Yeah.
Yeah, it means the conditions under which a vehicle is designed to safely operate on our roads.
Mm-hmm. And what does that include?
Well, that includes things like weather, things like geography, where you are, where you're located, you know, the conditions, if your vehicle is, you know, incapable of detecting school buses, for instance, perhaps you should avoid operating in the presence of school buses. If your vehicle is incapable of operating in, you know, heavy rainstorms, then you should be shutting it off when there's bad weather in the area. Similar to what Tesla's doing in Austin right now with their robo-taxis. Apparently, they just completely shut down the system during rain, which tells you a lot about their sensing systems and, you know, the capabilities that they have.
Well, I'm sorry, I got to jump in real quick before you go. Oh, wait, Michael, they shut down if it's raining?
Yeah.
So, okay, continue, Fred. Sorry.
All right. So that's what it should entail. But what I'm finding now is that the industry, through its standards organizations, is redefining operational design domain to mean a set of characteristics that the manufacturer says is acceptable for the operation of the particular vehicle. These may include geographic restrictions, geofencing, but does not necessarily include that. So what we're seeing at the same time is at the federal level and the state level that the industry is saying, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll only operate these things within the ODD and everything will be fine. But so here's the hook, right? If the ODD includes geographic constraints or geofencing or the capability for geofencing, then it's only good for the area that it's been defined for, right? So if you design it to operate in San Francisco, you cannot transfer it to Dubuque, Iowa and expect it to operate. So the industry is trying to get out of the interest of putting geographic constraints in and just saying, well, it's going to be designed to operate on 2-lane roads, 4-lane roads, 8-lane roads, what have you. So removing all the restrictions on geography that's associated with the ODD. So if you do that, then you find that at the legislator level, well-meaning but perhaps gullible legislators say, okay, well, you know, we know what the ODD means. We're only going to let you operate within the ODD, where the industry is trying to remove the barriers in the definition of ODD to say, well, the ODD is only what is included in the design requirements. So if those design requirements don't include any geographic restrictions, then we've got a system in which there are no restrictions on where and when it can operate because we didn't include it in the ODD. ODD is the designer's responsibility. So this runs into questions of when and how and if local legislators or local regulators could ever put a geofence in place for, we'll say, emergency characteristics, avoiding fires or avoiding, you know, immediate events, because the federal government says, well, it's got to operate within the ODD. We're going to go ahead and push these requirements down to the state. Or the state is saying, well, yeah, you can operate within the ODD, but the ODD is not specific for any of the state's local requirements. And if you cannot change the ODD by state fiat, for example, to say you need to change the ODD to stay away from these particular circumstances. We need to change the operational restrictions on this. Well, in order to put that into the ODD, what the industry is trying to do is to say, you need to go back and recertify the vehicle, because the ODD that we developed the vehicle to did not include any of these restraints. So there's a big hook here that the industry is trying to build into their requirements and the requirements they've agreed to say, basically, there is no restriction on the ODD, but sure, so we'll go ahead and we'll operate in accordance with the ODD, but wink, wink, there's nothing there that says we can't operate when and where we please. I'm just realizing this myself through my participation in some of the regulatory meetings, but whether or not this gap is intentional is unclear to me, but it's clear that the engineers who are involved in defining the requirements are pretty much lining up behind the idea that the ODD is the manufacturer's responsibility. And it's pretty clear that the lobbyists at the legislative level are not making clear to the regulators that this ODD is not something that you, the regulators, can manipulate or define or use as a way of restricting the vehicle operation when and where you decide it should be. So that's my topic, that there's a secondary level. And this actually goes back to a column that Junko Yoshida produced in Substack on July 8th, which was "Never Trust Another Driver, Even If It's a Computer Driver," which is about Tesla's driving on railroad tracks instead of paved roads. And quoting from her article, she says, "Koopman notes that society has a toolbox that could give victims some relief," and my interpretation, "from OEM's avoidance of their liability. The tools," he insisted, "range from regulation to litigation. His list includes regulatory recalls, tort liability reform, regulatory rulemaking, and product liability reform." Well, what we're seeing is that the industry is forcing people to sign away their rights to tort liability through the terms of service. The regulatory rulemaking is being neutered by misinterpretation of the ODD as well as the other design characteristics associated with the AV. For example, that the computer is always the driver, therefore there's nothing to sue. And product liability reform, which is not going to happen anytime soon, because the industry is saying, hey, you've signed away your rights, and I'm sorry that you as a pedestrian never signed away your rights and got run over by the vehicle, but hey, go ahead and sue the computer if you want. So I think there's some real jeopardy here. I think there's a lot of education that's needed for both the public, but also for the people who've got responsibility for designing the regulations for operations within local and state domains. That's it. Yeah.
And I think there's an inherent tension between strong ODD enforcement and the scalability of autonomous vehicles, right? I mean, you're not going, the whole point of strong ODD enforcement is ensuring kind of a slower and methodical process by which vehicles are designed to operate safely under all these different conditions, which is, in a lot of ways conflicts with the idea that you're going to be able to scale these vehicles fast across a large portion of the United States or the world.
Yeah, I also want to point out that the checklist we've provided for regulators includes consideration of the need to put geofencing into your regulations, particularly for local authorities to force AVs to avoid dangerous circumstances. So, we've got that covered, but people need to read the checklist in order to be alerted to that.
How does this work? Because as a New Yorker, Waymo is trying to operate in my fair city. And they asked for a license to operate in all of New York State, which was just nonsense, because they really don't want to operate in all of New York State. There's not enough customers. Most of New York State is empty. It's it's a lot of farmland and just parks, and it's empty. No one lives there. But they're trying to say, oh, look, we're getting pushed back and we really just want to operate in New York City. So how does that how does that work in terms of that design domain? Because I've been in vehicles where people have mistakenly, all of a sudden, they've turned in and now you're going to New Jersey. Like, there's no escape. There's no way for you to turn around. You missed the exit. The exit was closed. Some weird things happen. How does that operating design domain work? Who gets to define that? If this car starts operating, entering New Jersey, which New Jersey says, hey, we don't have a license for this stuff. Is it going to stop halfway when it hits the border? And what's the...
Well, that's a great question.
Thank you. Show's over.
The answer is that the manufacturers are trying very, very hard to exercise their individual and exclusive control over the ODD. That basically cuts out the ability of the local authorities to say, well, you know, this has got to be part of the ODD. The industry would say, no, that's an operational restriction. Well, that's fine, but there's no mechanism within the technical design constraints to exercise operational restrictions that are being imposed by local authorities. So the logical way to do this is to go back and modify the ODD for the vehicle within that operational jurisdiction, New York City or Hoboken or wherever it is. But the industry is saying, no, you can't do that because that's going to require recertification of the vehicle. The geographic constraints are not included in the original ODD. Therefore, the ODD is not applicable to this particular control situation. So it's kind of nefarious and slippery, but that's where industry's headed on this.
Well, if you're a local legislator, it happens to be in New Jersey, you definitely want an ODD. Keep those Waymos out. I'm just kidding. All right, so I have a real question for you guys. There was a big snowstorm recently, blanketed the East Coast. And as human drivers, let's say you park on a public street, plow comes along, boom, boom, boom. The next day, you're going to get your car out. What are the things you as a human have to do to your car to make it safe to drive?
Get the snow off the roof.
Snow off the roof. That's a good one. Fred, where else?
And dig it out. Make sure that you can see out of all the side windows. And make sure you can get into and out of the road safely.
Okay.
And
clean off your backup camera. Clean off those areas on your bumper where your ADAS or AEB or other sensors might be, your blind spot monitor sensors. I think it helps to know where all that is. I mean, functionally, you should be cleaning off the entire surface of your vehicle. I mean,
and in Boston, you got to make sure you can get to Dunkin' Donuts.
You know, I had a dream about Dunkin' Donuts, but that's a different podcast. So, these are all good things. And so what I'm wondering is, so autonomous vehicle company X, they have a vehicle parked, snow comes along, plow buries it. Who's cleaning all these things off? Like, is it Uber Eats drivers are going to come by and dig these cars out?
Oh, we don't even know, right? I mean, we know that say Waymo has these emergency response technicians that are in America. Maybe they go out and do it. But we also saw recently, didn't we, where they were some autonomous company was employing.
It was like Uber Eats drivers to close
trucks people to close the doors on their vehicles that weren't even affiliated with the company. So maybe they'll be employing, you know, the guy standing on the corner with squirt bottles and squeegees to clean them off. Who knows?
So one thing that you guys did not suggest that people need to clear in their car, which they absolutely need to, is and I watched this the other day outside my window, someone get into their Tesla and I watched them try to pull out and I was like, I don't care what vehicle they have. They're not going to have any traction as they slide around because they didn't clear out their wheel wells. So their tires were basically just hitting blocks of ice and they're spinning because they didn't clear out that part of the vehicle. Like, so that's another question for these AV companies. So you're going to hire a team of people to clear all the snow off of the roof, which is a law in New York State. Clear all the sensors off, which they need to make them operate, and then remind them to get in there and clear all the wheel wells out too. It seems, where's the cost saving in this?
Well, I think that they're going to include in the ODD the requirement that they park overnight at the top of a hill.
I'm just going to assume here that they'll have a facility that these vehicles will drive through that will spray them off or de-ice them or whatever needs to be done to ensure safe operation. But without requirements around that, who knows what's actually going to happen, right?
That's what we need in dense urban areas is less space for housing, more for automatic cleaning of AV vehicles. That's right. Housing, who cares? Waymo got to make the money. Yeah, and with that, let's go into an update for Donut, because Fred mentioned Dunkin' Donuts, and I dreamt about donuts. You guys remember Donut batteries? These are the guys claiming, hey, we have a solid-state battery. It's going to come out in a motorcycle in March. And just to recap, the benefit of a solid-state battery is it should be able to charge quicker. It should be able to last longer than lithium-ion. It should be safer because it shouldn't be prone to fires or thermal runaway events. And so everyone's kind of like, this is going to be amazing, or you're all full of nonsense. And so Donut now has said, yeah, well, here's some data. They had a test conducted by the state-owned VTT Technical Research Center of Finland. That concluded the battery is able to be charged significantly faster than a traditional lithium-ion battery. In several tests, the battery was able to charge from 0 to 80% in around 9.5 minutes. Which I know is too slow because you're like, hey, man, I got to get in my truck and I'm just racing, while retaining 100% of its capacity. In other tests, 0 to 80% was achieved in about 4.5 minutes while retaining 99% capacity. So I do not know anything about the State Research Center of Finland. I'm going to assume that they're not full of shit. So are we still thinking that Donut Labs has got the holy grail of batteries?
Well, there's a lot of gaps or a lot of hurdles between here and there associated with production and quality control and this and that. But the report that came out is very optimistic. So, hey, let's hope for the best, right? The holy grail is there. And all we need to do is send that holy grail out to the believers and everything will be fine.
Might be because sorry, Michael, go ahead. Oh, he's shaking his head.
It's still inconclusive here as to, you know, what's going on. You know, they've shown the ability to charge in that, but I don't think, you know, we really have any information on what the chemical makeup of the pack is. You know, there's also something that, you know, called a dendrite issue, which could be an issue causing electrical shorts, you know, as these batteries continue to operate. There's still a lot of questions around this, but, you know, Donut has set up a website called idonotbelieve.com. And their next report is coming out in 4 days, 21 hours, 33 minutes and 4 seconds. So we'll wait to see if they have any additional answers at that point, but, you know, they're pushing back on, you know, all the allegations that they're producing a scam solid state battery pretty strongly here. So it's why we're following this main for a lot of reasons. We really want to see, you know, safe solid state battery technology come out because it could reduce the weight of vehicles, reduce, you know, even though in this test, they saw some high temperatures reached that required the tests to be shut down. You know, we believe that an effective and a safe solid state battery could be produced in the future that will have, you know, no fire risk, which is very important. So this is still yet to be determined as to, you know, whether this is the real thing or, you know, what appears to be a pretty functional battery, but we're not sure if it's a functional solid state battery that will reduce some of the safety risks we've seen from weight and from thermal issues.
Well, I read about another battery chemistry that is touting many of the same claims. That particular battery technology includes lithium as well, so.
Yeah,
there's clearly a lot going on in solid-state battery development. Optimistic for the future that maybe they'll solve all these problems and you know, get away from the flammable lithium-ion polymer batteries that are currently out there.
So we're aspirationalists when it comes to solid-state battery technology. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I sent a link to you guys. There's a company in Australia where for marine usage, you can buy, they sell solid state batteries now. And it's not like coming soon. They've been selling them for at least a year.
Yeah, that I couldn't make heads or tails of that because it looked like those used lithium.
They have they have lithium, and they apparently have a little bit of electrolyte, but they list as solid state, and it's a real product. And obviously, on a boat, thermal fire issues are a major issue. So, like, you're not buying lithium ion batteries on a boat. They do lithium iron, which has much greater reduction of fire events.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have the weight issues on a boat either.
You do have the weight issues on a boat.
You do, but they're a lot less sensitive than the automotive issues.
Yeah. And when you crash into something, yes, definitely that thing is more of when you crash into something. Well, what were you doing, man? Come on. I had autopilot on. I went away.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Batteries are ballast.
Batteries are ballast. It's a new country album coming out by Michael Brooks.
It's all about my dog.
His dog's name is Battery. He has an eating disorder. All right, let's go into recalls. First up, Nissan, 318,781 vehicles. The 2024 to 2025 Nissan Rogue. Fractured gear could interfere with other internal ETC gears, potentially leading to loss of motive power, preventing forward or reverse gear engagement upon restart, increasing the risk of crash. So what happens? I start the car and the gears are broken.
It looks like you start the car and the over time there's a diagnostic routine that the car goes through.
It's not a propulsion gear. It's not a transmission gear.
It's a throttle
internal mechanism.
Yeah, and so the diagnostic routine actually causes over time the internal gear in the electronic throttle chamber to fracture, which results in a loss of motive power and a safety issue that I believe they're going to have to replace the physical module here. It looks like they're going to do an inspection to see if they need to replace the electronic throttle control part of the problem, and if the gear has been damaged in some way prior to the recall service. So that's going to be something that owners will probably hear about in early April.
Next up, Nissan. They're trying to be the Ford of Japan. 323,000 vehicle. Wait, is this the same thing? This is not the same thing. 323,917 vehicles, the 2023 to 2025 Nissan Rogue. If the engine fails while driving, it can result in a loss of motive power and an ability to restart, increasing the risk of crash. In certain rare cases, a bearing failure may cause a breach in the engine block, allowing hot oil to be discharged, increasing the risk of engine fire. Oh my God, if the engine fails while driving, this is not good. Bearing failures are not typically instantaneous and tend to progress over time. Oh, no. Allowing drivers to receive multiple forms of audible and visual advance warnings, including abnormal noise from the engine compartment, rough running, malfunction indicator lights, and warning messages in the instrument cluster. What is happening with Nissan?
This one is, the remedy here again is, essentially software and reprogramming something, even though we're seeing failures of a physical part of the vehicle. I mean, this falls into similar areas as our concerns with some of the previous Hyundai fire recalls that we saw that essentially, gave you a warning about the problem versus actually fixing the issue that's causing the defect. In this case, there is going to be an inspection for owners to try to detect if there's metal debris in the engine oil pan. And, it could be that some of these owners are going to be receiving new engines. However, for the vast majority, I think they're really just going to get a reprogramming of their engine control module to kind of maybe help them avoid the situation. And owners are going to hear about that around the same time as the previous recall and later on in March. So there may be some rogue owners here who are going to have two recalls coming their way.
Ouch. Next up, General Motors USA. 43,732 vehicles. The 2022 Chevrolet Tahoe, 2022 Cadillac Escalade ESV, the Cadillac Escalade, the GMC Yukon, Chevrolet Suburban, GMC, if the rear wheels lock up while driving, there's an increased risk of crash. Okay. Excessive wear within the transmission control valve body can cause a fluid leak, leading to a pressure drop that causes certain valves to move unexpectedly. Drivers may notice harsh shifting. So, the rear wheels locking up. Oh, God.
And once again, we see a recall remedy that is basically installing new transmission control module software to monitor and detect excess wear before this condition could occur. So once again, they are putting in software that hopefully will detect the problem before it occurs. However, they're not fixing the underlying defect that is responsible for the safety issue here. So, you know, this is the era of free calls, where manufacturers are looking for any software they can install in the vehicle on the cheap that could perhaps, we think, prevent the condition from occurring and creating a safety issue. But again, they're not fixing the underlying problem. You know, you're not being essentially in the past where you might have been made whole by a recall, by an actual fix to the defect that or the physical part of the vehicle that's failing. Now you're more likely to receive a software kind of avoidance programming that would prevent you from encountering the defect, even though the problem is still, you know, potentially going to happen in your vehicle. And, you know, hopefully these manufacturers, or all of them, are hoping that it happens once you're out of warranty, so they're not on the hook for it anymore.
As a consumer, is there any way I can force and be like, yeah, don't give me this software patch that doesn't fix the problem, that just kind of covers it up?
It's going to be tough without, you know, hiring an attorney and going to court, because they're simply going to say, you know, we've done a recall for this. We've essentially resolved the safety issue. So unless you can show that, you know, the vehicle is actually damaged in this area and that you're covered under warranty, then you're going to have to be forced to pay for the repair.
Well, with 43,000 potential owners, I imagine class action. No. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on next.
You just never know what you're going to get out of a class action, right? You mean,
you get a little postcard in the mail. It says, yeah, you're part of this. You get a dollar.
Yeah. Or you get, you know, $500 off your next GM.
Next up, Ford. That's right. The champion is back. You thought they were down, but they are not out. 412,774 vehicles. The 2017 to 2019 Ford Explorer. Fracture of a rear toe link diminishes steering control and increasing the risk of crash. The root cause has not been fully determined to date. The driver may notice a clunk noise, unusual handling, and a misaligned rear wheel. Ford. Come
on. Well, things happen, and this one looks like...
that's Ford's new motto. Things happen.
Yeah, things happen. They don't really know why the toe links are fracturing. But they haven't determined the root cause, but they're going to go ahead and replace those toe links. They're not going to use software, right? This is great. They're actually going to replace those toe links with a newly designed toe link. So I guess that's a good thing, right? Owners are going to hear about this probably in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Last up. That's right. They're back again. Ford. 15,965 vehicles. The 2025 Ford Transit. The brake booster pushrod may disconnect from the brake pedal. This can result in loss of braking function while driving, increasing the risk of crash. The cotter pin was not installed on the brake boost assembly at the vehicle assembly plant, and a subsequent operation to install a redundant retainer clip did not identify the missing cotter pin. Welcome back, cotter pin.
Yeah. Hey, nice.
Thank you.
This one is, a critical recall. They've listed it as a do not drive recall. So anybody that has these vehicles, I believe what it looks like from the recall report is that these were not completely manufactured vehicles, right? They weren't sold on dealer lots as Ford Transits. It looks like they were sold to an intermediate manufacturer who then finishes the conversion, you know, kind of a conversion van situation where they're the finished product is going to come from someone other than Ford based on the chassis of the Ford Transit. So that makes it a little more difficult to find the people who are operating these. And, you know, anyone who has a 2025 Ford Transit that is serving as the base for their delivery vehicle or whatever these are being used for, it's not totally clear from this, needs to be aware that this vehicle should not be driven until they have fixed this condition and welcomed back Cotter into the vehicle. Yeah.
In a situation like this where, you know, someone else is finishing the vehicle, does it maintain the Ford branding?
It could. A lot of manufacturers build what are essentially chassis on which they send off to an RV manufacturer or a manufacturer buses and all sorts of other things so that they can put, you know, the finished product, the seating and all of the different systems they're going to, you know, for RV manufacturers, your ovens, your heaters, right. You know, everything that goes in there and then are rebranded as, you know, Winnebago or whatever else, you know, they are. So it depends on the manufacturer, whether they're preserving any branding. It probably also depends on the agreement, any agreements made between the automaker and the secondary stage manufacturer.
Oh, so this is a tough one. So if you have a Ford Transit van or you suspect you have a Ford Transit van, get it checked out. Yeah.
Yeah. And it looks like they're mailing owner notification letters to these folks. It's always a concern there where you have, you know, a Ford selling an incomplete vehicle to another entity that should be collecting those owner names. Whether all these owners are going to get notified is a concern there.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, that is our show. We will be back, as always, next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is where you say thank you. Goodbye, Michael.
Bye, everybody.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.